Coming up, we got a loaded episode. We get Desmond Bane from the Orlando Magic, Adam Levitan, fantasy expert from Establish the Run, and leading the show, we get Kelly Eco talking about the Fred VanVleet injury, and then I riff on a bunch of other stuff going on around the NBA. That's all coming up right now. Let's get into some NBA news and notes, starting off with Kawhi Leonard. There's no news from Pablo Torre right now. There's just a lot of people talking behind the scenes about, well, what's going to happen next? What is the NBA going to look at here that we don't know about publicly? And one of the things that keeps coming up is what the CBA says about cap circumvention. Because if you look at Article 13, circumvention, which is Section 4, page 344 of the NBA CBA, it says this, and this is interesting here. It says, the system arbitrator shall have the authority upon good cause shown to direct any team affiliate, or player to produce any tax returns or other relevant tax materials disclosing income figures for the player. Now, that stands out for this reason, because we know about KL to Aspire. That's the LLC that was created November 22nd, 2021. That's what really started this whole investigation that Pablo Torre has really dug incredibly deep into on his podcast that Mark Cuban is still tweeting about every minute, it seems like. But what about the other LLCs? Because if you look at the California database or in Florida as well, there are a lot of LLCs that have been created with KL2 ever since Kawhi Leonard signed with the Clippers. This is publicly known information. This is not anything that you can have to dig deep for. But in California, for example, there were 16 KL2 LLCs that were registered. That's not abnormal for the super wealthy to have a bunch of LLCs like Kawhi Leonard is. But for the NBA, in theory, they could ask for the tax returns for all of these LLCs. And that's what's interesting here, because if you look at the timing of when these LLCs were created, three of them are all made very close together. There's this one called KL2 Content that was made December 28th, 23. There is one called KL2 RIFC Real Estate, made January 2nd, and then another one made on January 2nd as well. So there was three made within 10 days before Kawhi Leonard signed a contract extension with the Los Angeles Clippers worth 3 years and $153 million. That deal was signed or reported on January 10th of 2024. So this is just circumstantial observation here. This is all this is. But if the NBA is diving deep into this, they could ask for tax returns for all of these LLCs if they desired to. And that's what NBA executives are talking about right now in the conversations I've had. They're wondering, how deep in is the NBA really going to dive here? Are they going to go through all of these? Or are they just going to look at the Aspire stuff and kind of not worry about everything else that's out there? But the fact is that because of what we know about Aspire, because that's public information that Pablo Torre dug up because of what had happened with Aspiration. But the NBA says the NBA can compel Kawhi Leonard to have talks documents produced as part of this investigation. And so it's very possible me and you and the public aren't going to find anything else about this until, you know, the NBA does their investigation here. But the NBA can look into these LLCs, and they have the ability to do that. And I think that could help dictate their decision, whether it's to punish the Clippers or not, and how harshly they actually end up doing it. So just keep some of that stuff in mind, because the CBA does have that ability in there. Now, let's move on from Kawhi Leonard and talk about the real big news from this week in the NBA, and that is the injury of Fred VanVleet. And to do that, my new coworker, Kelly Eco, was hired by Yahoo Sports after 7 years with The Athletic. I'm very, very excited to have Kelly on the team. And here he is to talk about Fred VanVleet and what it means for the Houston Rockets. All right, Kelly, welcome to Yahoo. How you doing, man?
Hey, thanks for having me, Kale. See, this is a dream. This is a real dream come true. So, thank you.
I'm excited to talk to you. Unfortunately, under these circumstances, yeah. Fred VanVleet, torn ACL news came out on Monday. You had reported that it happened during a team mini camp in the Bahamas. Tore his right ACL. What was your initial reaction to this news, Fred VanVleet tearing his ACL, and how do you think it impacts the Rockets this year?
I mean, right off the bat, it's a bummer. You know, the Rockets, the whole point of this offseason that they've been trying to build was to plan for a legitimate title run. And at the center of that was Fred VanVleet, you know, the emotional leader on and off the floor. He's the extension of Ime Udoka on the court. He's the team's table setter, the organizer, the constructor, defensive playmaker, floor spacer, and just the consummate professional. So all their plans for this season, you know, had a pair with Kevin Durant. You know, I talked to Fred a lot during the summer, and everything that he was talking about was how efficient that two-man game will be, how it's going to open up things for Alperen Şengün, how it's going to allow guys like Amen Thompson and Reece Shepard to grow and develop quickly, and ultimately how it makes them a dangerous threat, you know, to the Thunder and the Western Conference. So now, all of a sudden, a week before camp, he's down for the season. So now you have to pivot pretty quickly. If you're Ime Udoka, how do you plan? You know, how do you change the lineup? How do you get the best five-man pairing on the floor at all times? You know, this is a large team, a defensively stout team, but offensively, can you be efficient enough in the half court? You know, the Rockets struggled a lot in the half court last season. They couldn't space the floor well. They couldn't hit threes at a consistent rate. How do you hang in the Western Conference when you have the likes of the Denver Nuggets, Oklahoma City Thunder, you know, the Clippers maybe, and just seeing what this looks like moving forward is going to be a big question.
I want you to hear me out with my process here. I think losing Fred VanVleet both lowers their floor and raises their ceiling. And what I mean by that is it lowers their floor because he's steady. Fred VanVleet is a good player. He's a veteran. He's important to that team with their mentality as a veteran, as a locker room guy. He's important. That's undeniable. But it also raises their ceiling in the sense that VanVleet has his limitations. He just does. He doesn't get to the basket. He's a small guard. He is, you know, statistically one of the least efficient clutch scorers in the NBA the last 4 or 5 years. He shoots near the bottom of the NBA at clutch moments, in part because he doesn't get to the basket, doesn't create easy shots, takes a lot of tough shots, contested three-pointers off the dribble, contested deep twos. So with him, it raises their ceiling in the sense that they're ripping the band-aid off now. More Amen Thompson, you get to see what you're going to get out of him. More Reed Shepard, is he going to be able to have more big games like he did down the stretch of last season with the limited opportunities he received?
Right.
He's an elite shooter. He's a really good playmaker. He's a playmaker on defense as well. So you get to see these young guys. You get to see more Şengün playmaking, a little bit of point KD as well. And I think with the Rockets, that's where, like, I keep coming back to. The floor is lower, but the ceiling is higher because now the Band-Aid has just been ripped right off, and these young guys are going to get thrown in the fire, particularly Amen Thompson and Reed Shepard, and you get to see what you have long wondered about those guys. That's why you took them in the top five, and now we're about to find out. They have no choice but to find out, and they need it from those guys. And they could be better than VanVleet when it comes to opening a championship window. But of course, there's no guarantees there. And that's the fear. And that's why there's so much sadness among Rockets fans now.
Yeah. So I kind of equate point guards to running backs in the sense of mileage. And you look at Fred at age 31, a lot of miles on his tank. And he talked about extensively over the summer, hey, if Amen and Reed step up and elevate their roles, I can take a step back. And going back to what you said about, you know, the Band-Aid coming off and allowing guys like Alpi, you know, who's had a great year of basket to really step into his own more of as a half-court offensive focal point, you know, kind of running actions through him. You bring in Durant, who's been a proficient playmaker as well. Allowing guys like Amen Thompson and Reece Shepard to play freely and fast, I think can do them a lot of good. And it really forces the Rockets to have some really tough conversations during camp because, face it, this is a team that they're going to be a lot of eyes on, you know, once camp opens up and preseason comes, because they're expected to compete with the likes of Denver, Oklahoma City, and the Western Conference pretty quickly. And having KD in that locker room, you almost are demanded to be a championship-level team, regardless of if you think you're ready or not. So, you know, Reed Shepard is a guy who the Rockets have talked about extensively internally as this is a guy that we believe super high on. you know, the whole thing coming into the summer was, if he takes that next step, we're going to give him more minutes, more touches, more usage, and that should translate, because going back to what you said, you've been very high on Reed coming out of college in terms of the defensive playmaking, the floor spacing, you know, just the way he can handle the ball. And if they're able to do more with him, I think it does raise their ceiling in terms of they might win fewer games in the regular season because Fred is, you know, he's a heavy guy that you can depend on. But in the playoffs, it might be if a man takes that second step, if Reed takes that second step, you can pair that with the likes of Kevin Durant, Şengün, and Dorian Finney-Smith and see what you have.
One of the questions I've had on my mind with this Rockets team, when we did our, you know, we're doing our division preview on my pod, and when we did the Rockets, yeah, my question was, do they have enough shooting still? Like, after adding Kevin Durant and after adding Dorian Finney-Smith, with this roster, you're shaking your head. You still don't think they have enough shooting, Kelly?
Yes and no. I mean, if you go back to last season, this was a pretty bad shooting team, but the bulk of their decent shooting, you know, is gone now. Fred VanVleet, Jalen Green, Dylan Brooks. Now you've brought in Dorian Finney-Smith, who is a good shooter. You can hit from the corners. He's excellent from the corners, actually. You bring in Kevin Durant, who's excellent everywhere from the perimeter. The question now becomes, does Alperen Şengün take that next leap in terms of becoming comfortable with taking threes and hitting them at a decent clip, maybe even low 30s? Amen Thompson, because, you know, if hit the ball in his hands, teams are going to go under screens a lot. You know, obviously he can get to the rim at will, but what does his next stage of development look like? And the biggest thing for the Rockets that's kept them from advancing in the playoffs last season was that half court lack of execution. The Warriors just went zone the whole series and said, we dare you to shoot 25, 33s to beat us, and they couldn't do it. So I'm not sure if adding Kevin Durant gives them much more proficiency in that department, but losing Fred at the same time, as well as, you know, Dylan and Jalen, it kind of puts them in a precarious spot.
Do you think they're true championship contenders without Fred VanVleet, or do they take fall into a lower category in your eyes at this point?
I think before the season started with Fred healthy, I had them kind of below Denver in terms of, if you were to rank Oklahoma City 1, Denver 2, Houston probably 2.5. I still think that they can win a series, because the playoffs ain't think it happened. And if you have Kevin Durant on your team in the playoffs, you should have, you know, a pretty good chance of advancing. But it's going to come down to the little things. Like, what do those young guys who have now had a year of experience in the playoffs look with going forward? And how do they react to adverse situations? Can they adapt on the fly pretty quickly? And that's going to tell me if this team is a true contender or not. I'll know by December.
I mean, one of the tough things for Houston right now is that they cannot sign anybody because they're against the cap right now. So they can't. And people are like, well, should they go get Russell Westbrook? Well, they can't do that. They can't. They're not allowed to. And when it comes to trades, they have a bunch of guys that aren't trade eligible at this point. And the guys that are trade eligible, you wouldn't move, as Yossi said in his post on screen here. Kevin Durant, Alperen Şengün, Jabari Smith, Amen Thompson, Reed Shepard, Tyrese. And you're not trading any of those guys who are trade eligible. So like Houston is in a position right now where I talked to like a bunch of executives over the last 24 hours since this injury happened. What do you think Houston's going to do? All of them say they're likely going to go into the year with the team that they have, play those young guys, then come December, January. That's where you think about what they're going to make for moves, make for trades. But Fred VanVleet still has a no trade clause because of the 2-year deal he signed, Kelly. So my question for you is, do you think with Fred VanVleet, he has a $25 million deal? That's a very, very, very tradable number, but he has the no trade clause. Do you have any indication or any insight into whether he'd be willing to waive that no trade clause? Because that would be the piece. That would be the piece you would want to move in the Rockets, right?
Yeah. Not at this time. I don't. I think it's still pretty raw in their existence. You know, I talked to them the other day and they said, look, this is the bed that we made. You know, if we're going to go into the season, these are the guys that we're going to go to battle with. So, you know, come December, you might have different conversations. You know, Clint Capella is making a team-friendly salary. You could see something with that. But outside of that, these are the guys that they want in their rotation. Ime specifically handcrafted this roster, right? And his identity is length, versatility, and size on the perimeter. Tyrese and Jabari Smith Jr., Dorian Finney-Smith, adding Josh Okogie, guys like Jayshon Tate. You want to have as many guys as possible. Now, yes, some of this comes down to whether or not Amen Thompson can take the reins and, you know, make that position his own. You know, he, if you talk to people that are close to him, they've always said that he's a guard playing power forward for the Rockets last season. Now he goes back to his natural position. What can that look like if you give him the keys and you flank him with Durant, Shingu, and Jabari Smith? What is it? It might look fantastic. Now, if Reed Shepard comes along and can give you legitimate production off the bench, if he actually can up his, I think he shot, 32% from three last season, about subpar PER, like 9.5. If he can come in and now he's shooting 38% from three and he's giving you 10, 11 points a game, 3 or 4 assists a game, suddenly the loss of Fred isn't as bad as you thought it could be potentially if those guys can fill that gap. So I think they have enough pieces right now to where they can stay afloat. Going back to what you said about lowering the floor, the real question will come, you know, mid-December if they're fifth in the Western Conference and they have these guys that are available to be traded. What, you know, does the front office get aggressive and creative, or do they just carry on and push on to the playoffs?
And I think that's going to be the big question there. Is like it's going to be a stage of evaluation for the youth. Like, does Amen Thompson take a leap? Does Jabari Smith, you know, does Alperen Şengün start shooting, you know, mid-high 30s from three? Like, do some of these younger guys raise the ceiling of this Rockets team? And then you're in a position where it's like, well, we should make an all-in move here. Fred, please waive the no-trade clause. Please, please. Or is it a position where it's like, you know, let's just stick with what we have and let's roll it out with this team. And Fred's part of the locker room. He's like an extended coach. And he's part of the reason of our early season success. And then he comes back next year and he's a sixth man for us. Maybe that's what it turns into. It's very, very, very hard to predict at this point. But the Rockets were already one of the most interesting teams in the NBA. I think they become more interesting to watch this year because removing the Van Vliet variable and now the increased opportunity for those other young guys. So I'm stoked. Like, opening night, man, like against Oklahoma City. And
oh, my God. This is going to be crazy.
Houston. Woo! I cannot wait. And so, Kelly, you get hired by Yahoo Sports from The Athletic after, I think, 7 years there covering the Rockets. Yeah. You're still going to be based in Houston, you said. And now you're hired as a national NBA reporter here with us at Yahoo. Yeah. What are you most excited about for the season? For your, whether it's personal with your job and traveling or something league-wide with the NBA, whatever it is.
I think what I'm most excited for is the ability to tell stories on a bigger stage and collaborate with people like you, Divine, Morton, just guys that know the game and want to tell good stories. I think the NBA content space, there's so much more to be delivered on. And I think coming here and allowing myself to spread and just work with talented professionals like yourself and just see what's out there, I think that's the dream come true. And we all love the game. We all love the sport, and being able to identify with the readers and the audience on a deeper, more intimate stage is going to be a dream come true for me. So looking forward to it.
I'm fired up to work with you, Kelly. I've loved your work for a long time, and it's cool to thank you, teammates, brother, with you. Appreciate you joining me today, man. We'll do that. Definitely pod again very soon.
Sir.
All right, so media days have gotten started this week already. Let's go through a few of the things that I've observed from our first couple of days of media day. With the New York Knicks, Mike Brown, I am loving everything he's talking about with this system, the way he imagines things for the Knicks. He wants more pace. He wants more drive and kick. He wants more movement. He wants to alleviate the pressure off of Jalen Brunson. I mean, look, Brunson, as amazing as he is, dude has been pounding the ball into the floor possession after possession after possession. Not a lot of diversity in that half-court offense, despite having Karl Anthony Towns, who can handle and run dribble handoffs, Mikal Bridges, OG Anunoby, among others on this team that can do stuff with the ball in their hands. It seems like that's the vision Mike Brown has for this Knicks offense. And to me, I think that's really exciting. And I hope the players embrace that, because that's what could make them serious, serious championship contenders, rather than doing a lot of the stuff that was very frustrating under Thibodeau over the last handful of years. You have Giannis Antetokounmpo in a translated interview. You know, he had some interesting comments talking about his future, his place in Milwaukee. He did say, like, he's fully invested, it seems, in the Bucks this year. He's thinking about leading that team in the Eastern Conference. But he made a very interesting comment. He said, look, I hope it never happens, but I'm expecting it too. Just because you've given a lot to a team doesn't mean the team doesn't do what's best for itself. And that was in regards to possibly being traded someday. And with the Bucks, we so often talk about, well, Giannis, what does he want for his future? Does he want to be part of the Milwaukee Bucks moving forward? We almost never talk about, well, what do the Milwaukee Bucks want for their future? And I think with Milwaukee, everything that they've done, all of their actions indicate a team that is desperate to keep Giannis happy. I mean, if you waive Damian Lillard and absorb that money over the next 5 years to sign Miles Turner, that is a risk. And also, like, it is, you're stomaching a lot of money on your cap moving forward when there's no guarantees of Giannis wanting to stay. But all of this is being done to appease him and optimize his chances of leading this team to another championship while he's still in a Milwaukee Bucks uniform. But things can change. Like, if the Bucks are a 500 team in this very weak, sad Eastern Conference, like, there's going to be teams calling up that are like, hey, we'll give you everything we have to go get Giannis. We'll give you 7 first-round picks. We'll give you all the swaps we have. We'll give you everything. And if you're the Bucks at that point, you might take a meeting. And I think that's why Giannis's comments were very honest and forward, because it seems he's committed to the Bucks. But in the back of his mind, he knows there's a possibility that it's the Bucks who end up saying, hey, we need to move on here. There's no path for us to create a championship contender. This is what was best for us, and hopefully it's best for you as well. So very interesting Giannis would come out and say that this week. We got some news from Jason Tatum as well. He did a bit of a media tour, kind of random. I think he did Good Morning America or one of those national morning shows. He did First Take, and that's where the big quote Tatum had came from. He said to Stephen A. Smith, I haven't said I'm not playing this season. The most important thing is a full recovery, being 100%, not rushing it at all, but also I don't go to rehab 6 days a week for nothing. That's what Tatum said. And on this podcast, every, you know, Boston media appearance I've done this year ever since the injury, I've pretty much said pretty consistently, I'm not ruling Tatum out from coming back. This is the dude who idolizes Kobe Bryant, who looks to be in great condition, got the surgery immediately from the best Achilles doctor in the world, Martin O'Malley, who, by the way, O'Malley had an interesting quote today as well in People magazine. He said, I don't think I've seen a person's calf look as strong as his. At 6 or 8 weeks, he was doing double heel rises. He worked his calf so hard that the side effect of loss of strength, I don't think he's going to have any. And that's Tatum's doctor himself who said that. And so, you know, I think all of this media tour stuff from Tatum getting out there doesn't necessarily mean he's going to come back. But I do think it's further evidence of a guy who is far in his recovery and who does have the intentions to return. And so for the Celtics, depending on the sports book you look at, they're plus 5,000 on, I think, BetMGM and FanDuel. They're plus 8,000 on DraftKings to win the 2026 NBA Finals. The East is so bad. Like, Cleveland's dealing with Darius Garland injury. They just signed Killian Hayes today, by the way. You know, good for them to give Killian a chance. I'm still rooting for Killian. And then the Knicks, of course, you know, new coach, new system, no guarantee to work. The Magic, did they add enough shooting? And other than that, I don't really think you can make an argument for any of these teams as like they're a championship contender. But if Boston is on a 46-win pace, with Peyton Pritchard having a good year and so Jaylen Brown even better next season and some of these younger guys off their bench having good years, maybe Tatum comes back in March and suddenly Boston reinserts itself back into the championship conversation. And we'll see. You know, health is going to be number one. He very well might miss the entire season and maybe that'll be for his best, but I'm not ruling it out unless he rules it out. And so far that has not yet happened. We did get another piece of news. The Warriors, according to Mark Stein over on his Substack, said regardless of what happens with the Kuminga situation, once that ends, the Warriors will be signing Al Horford, Seth Curry, Gary Payton II, and De'Anthony Melton. This Warriors roster, with all those veterans, it makes more sense. it works, you know, a bit better with some of those guys. I like them signing some energy off the bench with Seth Curry. But to me, I look at this team and I'm just like, Kuminga doesn't want to be there. He's holding all of this up. He's not a great fit. And we'll see if he signs a qualifying offer, which I doubt. I would expect he takes that 2+1 deal, whether it's the team or player option. Of course, he wants the player option. I just think it would be short-sighted of him not to take that life-changing wealth that he would be able to receive by taking that deal. It's $50 million. Like, let's be real. A lot of us would do crazy things for $50 million. So signing an $8 million one-year deal, that's not going to last you forever if you're coming in. He should take the 2+1, in my opinion. And then if you get traded, it's going to be to a team that wants you. And for the Warriors, that's why they want that deal. But regardless of the Kuminga situation, I like the Horford acquisition. If that actually happens, Curry, Payton, and Melton coming back as well, it all makes sense for the Warriors. We'll talk about that more once there's more clarity, but wanted to highlight that because it was reported by Mark Stein, and he is as solid as it possibly gets. But right now we get Desmond Bane talking about the Orlando Magic, how he envisions his role on the team this season, what's going to go on with Orlando, what they need to do to be championship contenders. So here's Desmond Bane right now. All right, joining me now from the Orlando Magic, Desmond Bane. Desmond, how you doing today, man?
Man, blessed. Excited to be on the show.
I appreciate you joining me today, man. Orlando, of course, made a massive change this offseason, and that's acquiring you. I'm curious, entering the team this season and your time in the past with Memphis, what was your assessment of this Magic roster from the outside, and how does your presence on the team change it?
I think they have a unique roster. You know, the size that they have on this roster is unreal. I mean, you look at Jalen Suggs, a big guard. Anthony Black's a bigger guard. And then next to them, you have 6'10 wings and forwards. So it's no secret to why they were such a good defensive team. And now it's about converting on those stops, you know, and getting out in transition is something that Franz just did extremely well in Eurobasket, something that I've done well throughout my career. Jalen Suggs likes to run. So I think that it's going to look a lot different this year on the offensive end, but, you know, a whole lot of the, you know, same things that you've seen defensively. I'm super excited. The guys are really good guys. The organization just bred on good people. So seems like we got a chance to do something special.
2 years ago, you attempted a career high 8.6 three-pointers per game, and then last year you were down to 6.1, which was your lowest since your rookie season. So your three-point rate has fluctuated kind of a lot over your career with different systems and whatnot over the years in Memphis. Do you expect to be, you know, shooting possibly a career high amount of threes for the Magic this year? Because that's what's missing is three-point shooting. Would you expect to maybe be cracking 8-9 threes a game this year?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's the goal. We've been playing and scrimmaging over the last 2 weeks, and it's very apparent what they want from me. You know, they want me to shoot threes. They want me to be aggressive to score the ball and play make. So every time I turn down a shot or they feel like I can get a shot off, they're letting me know about it. So I think that I'll definitely be at career numbers as far as attempts go.
I mean, last year, Orlando's bottom 10 in three-point percentage and three-point attempts, and they add you, they draft Jace Richardson. And of course, I think the underrated overlooked signing in all this is Tyus Jones. Tyus Jones has been over 40% from three last three seasons. He's not just elite assist turnover ratio guy as a point guard. He's also an elite spot up shooter. So, I mean, that from my perspective, I think like maybe adding one more shooter would be nice, but the additions that have been made, I feel like Tyus Jones has been kind of overlooked in all of this personally, and you played with him before. So what does Tyus Jones add to the Orlando Magic?
Man, I mean, you hit on it from a lot of things he does on the court, but I mean, in the locker room, he's going to be fantastic as well. I mean, we called him Stones in Memphis, you know, because of some of the big shots he made, but he's also, you know, like a rock to a team, you know, a guy that people can lean on. You know exactly what you're getting from Tyus. Like, he's never too cool to hang out and crack jokes or whatever, but whenever you're on court, court is super serious. So he's going to be huge for us and help, you know, guys like Jace, guys like Jalen, Anthony Black, all those guys, really show them the ropes and what it's like to have longevity in this league as a point guard.
When it gets reported that the Magic give up 4 firsts, swap KCP, Cole Anthony for you, there is a lot of reaction on social media. Some Magic fans like, yes, this is exactly what we needed. Some Memphis Grizzlies fans are like, oh, wow, we lost Desmond Bane. This sucks. Mm-hmm. And then a lot of other fans are like, wow, the Magic gave up that much for Desmond Bane. Mm-hmm. I think a lot of people don't know how good you actually are as a player and also how you fit in the Magic. Mm-hmm. But there are a lot of people who were surprised.
Sure.
What was your reaction to the reaction when some people are like, wow, the Magic gave up that much for him?
Yeah, I mean, it really doesn't move me one way or another. You know, to when I had talks with Jeff, you know, kind of similar to some of the stuff you're saying, like he feels like I was one of the missing pieces to get them over the top. And, you know, if that's the case, then those 4 first-round picks would fall to the end of the draft, you know, as it is. So it's my job to go out there and win basketball games and prove the decision right. And that's what we're going to do.
I mean, you've always kind of been a prove it guy. Like in high school, you weren't recruited by top colleges and you go 30th. A first round pick is an honor, but 30th, you're not a lottery guy. And then now this is happening with the trade. This is kind of the norm for you and your kind of basketball career.
It's a great spot to be in. You know, I mean, in Memphis, we started winning and, you know, I kind of felt like we expected to win, you know, and it's super hard to win in this league. So it's good to be, you know, have that mindset of prove it, you know, and, you know, really, really pour that into the guys.
So when I look at the Magic roster, it's, you know, Paolo and Franz and Jalen Suggs, Wendell Carter, Tristan Da Silva.
Hey, he's a Anthony monster, too.
He had a great Eurobasket. Oh, Wendell Carter.
Tristan played great, too. But yes. Wendell's going to be the X factor for us. You'll see.
Why do you say that as an X factor?
If you look at, like the fives, modern-day five and the NBA, I mean, Dell can switch 1 through 5. He's making great decisions in the pocket on his rolls. He's finishing strong around the rim, shooting threes. Just be about staying healthy, staying confident. But I think he's the guy that can really open everything up for us.
I mean, you mentioned his role as a versatile big man on defense and on offense as well, with his passing ability out of DHO, short roll passing, everything. And everything like that. I mean, I think that's where, like, when I look at you, I'm like, okay, Franz and Paolo can run pick and roll as 6'10" dudes. Wendell Carter can play different roles offensively. And you, as somebody with your size, you can run pick and roll. You can be a spot up guy. You can come off screens. You can even set screens for that matter as well, because you're so strong. I feel like there's just so much potential versatility. What has your role looked like in some of these, you know, early practices you've guys had? Is there a versatility there where you're plugged and played into maybe more spaces than you've ever been before?
I'm doing everything. I mean, I think you hit it on the head. Like, get it off the rebound and go. I'm playing hit and chase. I'm coming off of off-ball screens. I'm playing pick and roll. There's really no limitation to what I do on this team and in this offense. And kind of touching on that point you were talking about with Wendell, like the best years that I feel like I had in Memphis was playing alongside somebody like Steven Adams, like who can screen, who's smart, can pass. So now I can leverage my cutting, you know, and all those things. And now I feel like I'm in a position to be able to do that again.
And with you, it's interesting because I feel like with the Magic, there's so much potential for two-man actions. Obviously, with pick and rolls with, you know, Paolo screening for Franz or you screening for Paolo, just so many different combinations, them screening for you and so on. But with like DHOs as well, it's interesting when you look at Jamal Mosley and the 4 years he's coached the Magic. His first year coaching Orlando, they ranked 2nd in the NBA in handoffs per game. That has fallen each season from 12th to 20th to 24th. And I don't think that's unsurprising because of the lack of shooting that's been on the team. But I think with the personnel, there's so much potential for installing some of that stuff, which I think were his early intentions with offense.
Sure. For sure.
You know, and do you kind of see some of that, like with playing with Paolo, playing with Franz, playing with Wendell Carter, with those DHOs, with you kind of coming through? Because in your career, You've shot over 40% from three out of dribble handoffs. You obviously can get to the rim as well. It just feels like something that can work on paper.
Very, very natural for me. I mean, you know, one of the things that I've kind of struggled with in my career is like when you have the like perimeter defenders like OKC that crawl up in the ball and now I'm asked to initiate offense or come off a pick and roll with, you know, aggressive defenders. But when I'm playing at DHO, now that kind of takes that out of the equation and I'm getting an advantage off of leveraging my shot and my cutting. But we've been drilling a lot of that. You know, it's early, so we're not like full practice or nothing along those lines. But with a little bit of structure that we've been given, DHOs are definitely in the cards.
I mean, it's going to be different, obviously, especially compared to last year in Memphis, because that was like a system unlike anything. Like,
there weren't
a lot of handoffs and pick and rolls or anything like that.
For sure.
What was your reaction when that system was initially installed last season?
Yeah, during training camp, I was like, man, this here is crazy. You know, like, we'll see if it works type of thing. Like, I don't think anybody was just surefire, gung-ho on it. But once we started playing, like, it was evident that it works. You know, I mean, like, you play with space, continuous movement. I mean, a lot of guys were flourishing in it, you know, being able to play at multiple different spots. It's a very, very, very versatile offense that a lot of teams started to pick up on, like, throughout the season. Like, they started cutting and started doing different things, you know, whether it was out of their pick and rolls or whatnot. But, yeah, Noah was definitely on to something with some of those offensive principles.
You feel like there's anything you learned that could be, that's like made an impression on you moving forward in your career?
From him?
Yeah, or anything in that system, that whole experience last year. Because obviously there's a lot of ups and downs. Like a coach gets fired last year, right?
Yeah.
Including Noah.
For sure.
Is there anything that you take forward in your career?
Yeah, I think that I learned that I can be good in just about any system. Like, I mean, I came back from my oblique injury and I struggled early on. And then once I kind of got in shape and got my legs under me, like, I was playing very efficient basketball, like, had months shooting over 50%, 40% from three. So, like, just my adaptability, like, come in, okay, I'm a spot shooter. And then, like you said, I'm playing off of DHOs and then Ja goes down and misses some time. And now I'm, you know, primary creator, primary scorer. And last year, you know, it's just like get in where you fit in type of thing. Like, whether I'm passing, rebounding, scoring, just adding layers to my game. So I feel like I'm in a position to be successful wherever I land.
I feel like when I look at the Magic roster this year, everything's there. Like, all the role players, the upside pieces. And I think the swing piece, though, I still think it comes down to, like, what version of Paolo Banchero are the Magic going to get? Is it going to be more of like the up and down and consistent inefficient scoring during the season, or like just pure dominance beginning of last season before the injury or during the playoffs when he was like unstoppable, 40%+ from three, elite from mid-range, getting anywhere he wanted on the court? I feel like from my perspective that Paolo is the guy who determines your ceiling this year from like championship contenders or just like really good team that takes a big step.
Mm-hmm.
But I think Banchero taking that step moving forward is key to that this season. Have you practiced with him so far as well?
Yeah, we just had a team mini camp in Vegas. So everybody was there. We went to the fight. Really good just to get around everybody. But me and P, we spent a lot of time together. Had really good conversations at the dinner we was at, whether it's recovery sessions or whatever. Like, we had very good conversations. And he's going to be a monster. I mean, and the thing that I like about him a lot is he's very selfless. Like, he just wants to win. And I feel like that's rare around, like, you know, number one picks, young all-stars. Like, everybody's still trying to make a name for themselves and chase. But he understands that, you know, winning comes first. And if we win, all that stuff will take care of itself. So I expect a big season out of him. And I think he expects a big season out of himself. And more than anything, I could just feel the hunger, you know, that he has coming into this season. So I'm super excited to get around him and, you know, happy to be able to compliment his skill set.
I mean, he got a taste, you know, like sometimes you go to the playoffs for the first time and you experience that on that stage. And also he's really good. He played his best he ever has in the playoffs. Yeah. It's probably kind of instills some confidence as well. Like, okay, I can do this on this stage and you build on that moving forward. And your current, I mean, with you, like at this stage, you've signed a $200 million contract. You've traded for four first round picks. That is an honor. It shows how you're valued by another team. You've had great success in your career so far, even though, you know, you're still chasing a championship as well. How would like high school Desmond Bane react to all the success you've had?
Probably wouldn't believe it. You know, like I tell the story all the time. Like once I got to TCU, like it was like my I made it moment. You know what I'm saying? Like where I come from, like people don't make it that far, you know, so that I wasn't even thinking about the NBA, like overseas, you know, was a potential, but I wasn't even thinking about it and, you know, worked my way into the door and never, you know, changed my work habits or, you know, who I was. And, you know, this thing's just kind of taking off. So it's cool to look back and see how far and like see the journey and stuff like that. But, you know, now we're here and it's time to really stamp it. Like you said, you get that championship.
You weren't even thinking NBA when you went to college? No, entered your mind yet?
No. Like really? it was like play as a junior, you know, like I committed to TCU 2 weeks before I graduated high school, you know, so it wasn't like, you're, you know, sought after or whatever. I was like, oh, I'm a roster filler, like kind of questioning whether or not I was even good enough to play high major basketball because that was my only high major offer I had. So it was just more so like I'm in a Big 12, like bright lights, you know, I'm starstruck, if you will.
Wow. So it wasn't really until your junior year that you first kind of had the NBA dream enter your mind. It wasn't like when you were 10, 11 years old, there wasn't that dream as a little kid at all.
I mean, I always wanted to, but I'm realistic, you know what I'm saying? Like I'm realistic. Like I thought that was like impossible. You know, I never met anybody that had done it or even came close, you know, so.
You ever tell your, I know your great grandparents helped raise you. Did you ever talk to them about it when you were a kid?
Oh yeah. I mean, I would like, I grew up with a basketball. Like my grandma used to tell, this story all the time. Like Mike, I'm sure you've seen that movie. Like I told her, I don't want to, like, I was 3 or 4 years old when I watched it. And I said, I don't want to play for the YMCA anymore. I want to play in the NBA. You know what I'm saying? So like, it's been in my heart forever, but you know, dream big and who knows what'll happen type of thing.
What's one of the best lessons they taught you as a kid?
Probably just respect, you know, like treat everybody the way you want to be treated. Like it's cliche, but like they really live by that. And, you know, I've been around super talented guys like that just couldn't put it together off the court or with the way they handle themselves or the way they treat others. And, you know, it'll get you a long way. Open some doors, at least give you opportunities.
Did you know, being raised by two people so much older than you kind of change your perspective on life and approach to life? Because it's very different than like a lot of peers, of course.
100%. I mean, you come home every day and they're either taking care of the yard or playing on a computer, like reading a book, like very, very simple life, you know, like, and it was filled with love, like family always coming to cookouts on the weekends and stuff like that. So, like you said, it really put things into perspective and taught me what was important, you know, in life. And it's kept me grounded through the NBA. You know, in the NBA, you can lose yourself, you know, and everything that comes with it. But, you know, they set the foundation for me.
I mean, you're married yourself now with two kids, right?
Yeah, it's crazy, right? It's crazy.
How'd fatherhood change you?
Man, it took the, I'm not gonna lie, like I love basketball more than anything in the world besides my family and my kids, you know, like before, like I had outlets, but it was hard to really let myself be involved in those outlets, like when I'm struggling or whatever, just because like I didn't love those outlets as much as basketball, you know what I'm saying? But, like my family's kind of giving me that, like you said, perspective. It just puts everything in place. Like my kids are forever, might play 10 more years in NBA or whatever it's called. But, you know, those are my kids and my family's forever.
And now if you have like a 2-for-11 shooting performance, you go home and you have a little kid running up to your leg, right?
Yeah, exactly. It's like, all right, well, get back in the gym tomorrow and try it again the next day. You know, it's not like I can't sleep that night no more, you know?
Yeah, there's bigger and better things in life. But Desmond, best of luck this season in Orlando. I'm excited for you, man. And I mean, you know, I liked you pre-draft. I think I had you 19th or 20th on my board, and it's cool to see you reaching the heights you have.
We kept slipping, man. We kept slipping. You and them other folks had my hopes up, man, and I was going into teens, man.
Oh man, yeah. I've had a lot of misses in my career of ranking players, but I'm happy I had you ranked top 20. And yet that was too low. I should have had you ranked higher. I'm not too bright, am I? Yeah. Thank you so much for joining me today, Desmond. Appreciate it.
Appreciate it, bro.
All right, it's time for 6 points. Let's talk some NFL with Adam from Establish the Run. Adam, how you doing today, man?
Doing well. Appreciate you having me on.
I got 6 questions and observations for you, starting out with a fantasy angle here with this first one. Cam Scataboo, week 3 breakout for the Giants. Ashton Jeanty continuing his struggles. Who's your pick for rest of season rankings here between Scataboo and Jeanty?
Oh my gosh. Are we here already with Jeanty, who was a first round pick, and Scataboo, who went roughly round 9 or 10? I mean, it makes a big difference that Tyrone Tracy is out with a dislocated shoulder. Looks like it's going to be, I don't know, anywhere from 2 weeks to 6 weeks, sounds like, on Tyrone Tracy. We'll see. It makes a huge difference, right? Because Tyrone Tracy was actually playing ahead of Cam Scataboo, started that game on Sunday night against the Chiefs. And also, Tyrone Tracy is a very good pass catcher. He actually played wide receiver in college. So it's big to me that Scataboo not only, of course, is going to get more work now, but those specific passing game role where Scataboo can play very well in the pass game as well, can excel. And the other good thing going on with Scataboo right now, I think, is they get Jaxson Dart in there ahead of Russell Wilson. And so the offense, I think, is going to function better. And obviously more touchdown opportunities is better for the running back who's in there. So I would still take Jeanty ahead of Scataboo pretty clearly. The Raiders, I think, are going to be dedicated to getting Ashton Jeanty 15, 18, 20 carries. And I think they'll get into some better game environments as it goes on here. But yeah, I understand that it's bad on Jeanty right now. I think his biggest issue is that he's not playing in passing situations. They're using Dylan Labby and they're using Zamir White in these long down and distance situations, 2-minute drill, 4-minute drill, 3rd and 6. Jeanty's not in there. And when you're on a bad team and you have a bad offensive line, you need to be in there for those little quick hitters, those swing passes. So I think Jeanty will eventually get there, but they're just not comfortable with him in there right now for that. But yeah, I still think pretty easily Jeanty over Scataboo just on raw talent, team dedication. But certainly Scataboo is a big riser right now.
I think that's very fair with Jeanty, of course. I mean, at this point, he has the volume, he has the raw talent, and he still was a first-round pick for a reason when you're betting on his upside. I mean, it is interesting with him right now. He's pretty much getting nearly, you know, 25.7 PPR points for Jeanty to 40.9 for Scataboo so far through 3 weeks. But Ryan McFadden had a good post on X where he said how Ashton Jeanty has been hit at or behind the line of scrimmage on 11 of his 17 rushes versus Washington. That's now 57% of his rush attempts for the entire season. So with Jeanty, are you betting on the offensive line to improve with him moving forward? Because I think in the back of my mind, Adam, what I'm wondering is he a buy low after 3 weeks, or is he more like a sell before the stock plummets?
I don't think you can sell now, right? Like, what are you really going to get for him now? If somebody was trying to give him away, they're 0-3 and they're trying to give him away for someone that I think belongs, desperate. You know, yeah, people are going to be desperate now. I get that. We have seen running backs succeed with bad offensive lines before, right? I don't want to completely excuse what's going on here. Just be like, oh, it's the offensive line. That's it. They're going to get into better game environments. You saw it with Amari Hampton, who I know we're going to get to in a second. People left him for dead after weeks 1 and 2 also, sometimes it just takes the right game environment for players to succeed. So I think that the Raiders have to justify using the sixth overall pick, start using him in the pass game, start trying to structure things better. And who knows what's going to happen with Pete Carroll's son, who's the offensive line coach. The Raiders fans are already up in arms. Why do we have Pete Carroll's son as our offensive line coach? Let's get someone more competent in there. So we could see a move there at some point also.
And with Scataboo, you mentioned that Jackson Dart will be starting quarterback for the Giants starting in week four over Russell Wilson. What's going to be Scataboo's impact? What's going to be Dart's impact on Scataboo in this Giants offense?
Well, I mean, Russ is just incapable at this point in his career. I mean, he was with the Broncos and he was dreadful, gets run out of here despite them owing a ton of money to Russell Wilson, run out of Pittsburgh, and now run out of New York after just three starts. It's clear he can't play anymore, right? He's not a starting quarterback in the NFL anymore. So the unknown with Jackson Dart, just like, hey, maybe he's really good. And obviously that would be really good for the entire offense and Scataboo. Also, if you watch the preseason, I mean, Jackson Dart was, and I know people hate when we talk about preseason because it's meaningless. They're playing against dudes who are going to be packing groceries at Target next week or whatever. Jackson Dart played against the Bills starters. Played against the Bills starters and shredded. I mean, shredded. And like, he had 75 preseason snaps, and they were really, really impressive stats. So it doesn't mean it's going to carry over, but it's at least a good sign. And from what I saw with Jackson Dart in the preseason, it's like, if he can play anywhere close to that, it's going to be great for Cam Scataboo. I will say that Russ Wilson's target rate at running back is among the league's highest. And so I'm not sure it's going to be sticky to Scataboo here, but he is a very good pass catcher. So I do think pass catching will be okay, if not good, for Scataboo here going forward.
I mean, anything is going to be better than what Russell Wilson did that final drive, just throwing the ball away, the intentional grounding. That was one of the most perplexing series of plays I've ever seen. What the hell was going on, Adam?
Yeah, no, he just can't play anymore, you know, and the Seahawks, even going back to, he had an incredible run with the Seahawks, and I was like shocked when they let him go, but they knew, you know, I mean, they knew they were on it. The Seahawks, this was a long time ago where they just basically let Russell Wilson go, and yeah, they were right.
All right, second point here. Jonathan Taylor off to an absolutely sensational start this season. I was a dummy and took Josh Jacobs over him in my league. I'm regretting that completely right now. Where do you think Jonathan Taylor goes in a redraft? Is he number one at this point?
I believe we had him fourth last week in our rest of season top 150 rankings. It's hard not to have him first or second right there with guys like Gibbs and Bijan.
Is it just the injury concern kind of holding him back from being that right now?
I don't think so. I just think those guys are also awesome, right? Like, what holes can I poke in Bijan Robinson or Jahmyr Gibbs? Also, yeah, Jonathan Taylor's playing more snaps as they see on your screen there, but the role for Bijan and Gibbs as a pass catcher is better than it is for JT. I will say this. This is a change for what we've seen in JT's career. For his career, he has typically been a two-down back, more of a Derrick Henry type of back than the full, hey, we're going to play him 95% of the snaps. He's going to run 70%, 80% of the routes. We're going to design plays to get him the ball in space and screens. That is not the way that JT's been used for most of his career. This is the first year that it is happening, and it is incredible because he is an explosive talent. If you watch that 46-yard touchdown run in week three, you watch some of the runs he had last year, even the one that he dropped at the end zone before he was going in. I mean, guys do not touch the ball in the NFL that often, 25, 28 times, and also have this crazy explosive ability. We see it with Saquon. We see it sometimes with Derrick Henry when the Ravens have a good lead in a game. But like, even Gibbs is giving up work, and some other guys like that, almost everybody else is giving up some work if they are this explosive. So it is an outrageous setup for JT. And you mentioned the offensive line with the Raiders. Colts offensive line is absolutely balling out right now. So I think that this can actually sustain for Jonathan Taylor for the whole season.
All right, number three, Calvin Ridley this year, only 8 catches on 21 targets for 111 yards through 3 weeks so far. Is it going to be this bad all year with Calvin Ridley?
I don't think so. They have had some brutal matchups. Like, I don't know who came up with this schedule for Cam Ward. He has four of the toughest defenses in the NFL to start, and he hasn't had J.C. Latham, his right tackle, and they were missing Kevin Zeitler in week three. So it's been absolutely brutal. Bill Callahan, Brian Callahan, giving up play calling duties to the quarterback's coach here. God, you know, will that matter? It can't hurt, because right now they are the worst offense in the entire NFL. I still think Calvin Ridley's usage has been good. He's out there for almost every single route. And if you actually watch, like, Cam Ward, he flashes some things that are really exciting. It's just been such a mess lately with, or at least this his whole NFL career, in terms of matchups, offensive line play. So I think they're going to settle down the offensive line. Cam Ward's going to settle down. They're going to get better matchups. And Calvin Ridley is their best wide receiver. So, yeah, I think that it's going to be okay for Calvin Ridley. Not as excited as I was about him before the season, and I was excited about him, but it's going to be okay, I think.
I made Calvin Ridley my keeper in my league because I'm a dumbass. And my hopium or copium so far is, if you look at the players, the six wide receivers with 21 targets on the year so far, Calvin Ridley is a big outlier here in terms of production. You know, eight catches, the lowest of the six players with 21 targets, 111 yards, the lowest, 19.1 PPR points, by far the lowest. Egbuka has 51, Debo Samuel 44.9, Cortland Sutton 43.5, Ladd McConkey 31.3, Jerry Jeudy 23.4. Calvin Ridley, I just can't see it being this bad all year long, especially, like you said, with the flashes Cam Ward has had. Maybe this is just me just with some hopium here, but I just don't see how it's this bad, even if it's not as exciting as I might have hoped.
Sure, and they're going to have better matchups. Not this week, though. They're at the Texans this week. We'll see if Derek Stingley's able to play. He got hurt in week three, but after that, he starts to get softer, right? You get the Cardinals, you get the Raiders, you get the Patriots. They have a game against the Saints in Fantasy Championship week, week 17. So I don't want to give up on Calvin Ridley, but my outlook for him is definitely shifted from before the season, mostly because the Titans just look so dysfunctional. Even if I think it's going to get better, I can't deny it's been so dysfunctional.
And he has competition for targets as well. And that's part of it with Ridley. Next point here, number four, the Eagles. They had a 19-point comeback against the Rams. Miracle at the Meadowlands 2, people calling it. In this game, Jalen Hurts, after barely throwing the ball downfield at all, had a much, much better performance. What were some of your key takeaways on the Eagles side with this comeback that they had, especially with Jalen Hurts?
Yeah, no surprise whatsoever. When the Eagles get down and Jalen Hurts is forced to throw, he is a very good thrower and can support multiple fantasy wide receivers. Like, it's clear. Anytime, look back at the Super Bowl. Jalen Hurts has been dominant in Super Bowls as a thrower. So I always thought this was the case. I thought they were playing too conservative in weeks one and two, kind of playing to tush push, playing with a lack of aggression out of fear of mistakes, right? Because when you have such a good team, they have the most talented roster in the NFL, they have an amazing defense, they have an amazing run game and offensive line. When you have that, why take risks, right? And so they play extremely conservative and try not to make mistakes, which I actually think is fine to try to win. However, maybe this game against the Rams was a wake-up call. Like, if we try to play this conservative game style, we're going to get down 26-7 to good teams like we did to the Rams in some instances. And we're going to have to, you know, block a field goal at the end to win games. So my hope is that this is actually a wake-up call for the Eagles. Hey, we need to start playing more aggressively. We cannot play just to set up tush pushes. We cannot play just to not make mistakes. Because when we play good teams like the Rams, we play the Bucks this week, you know, you're going to have big games in the playoffs. You need to be able to score aggressively. So I kind of think it's a wake-up call for the Eagles. And I always thought that they had it in them. Like, panicking after 2 weeks was warranted only if you thought they'd just dominate every single game and never have to throw again. And obviously in the NFL, crazy things happen and that's unrealistic. But like I said, even in like normal games now, I kind of think that hopefully this will wake them up to be more aggressive.
it's just an awesome game, man. Like, it's just such a fun game to watch. And with Jalen Hurts, I mean, I do understand some of the criticisms of him, but when I watch this dude, I see an elite game manager when he's asked to do that, and a guy who can step up in the moments that he has to as well and be a downfield thrower. Why do they not let him do that all the time? I wonder. I mean, like, do you have any theories of why they don't always play with that aggression?
Yeah, I just think that they think they have one of the best defenses in the NFL. They have one of the best offensive lines and maybe the best run game or one of the best run games. So why force it, you know?
Like, minimize risk, essentially?
Yeah, and they've won something crazy, you know, like 17 of 18 games or something crazy. So, you know, playing this style, why change it? But like I said, like in the Super Bowl, they changed it. They came out very aggressive in the Super Bowl, knowing they had to score points to beat Patrick Mahomes. So the game plan can vary from week to week, I think, based on opponent a lot for the Eagles.
All right, number five, Omarion Hampton had 19 carries for 70 yards, 6 catches for 59 yards. What fueled his breakout performance?
Yeah, well, at the time of Najee Harris's injury in this game, and Najee Harris was lost for the season with a torn Achilles, Najee had 6 opportunities, and Omarion Hampton only had 5. So what fueled it was Najee Harris getting hurt, right? And like, people are going to try to tell you otherwise, that Omarion Hampton was on his way to breaking out anyways. Maybe, but we'll never know now. We'll never know. The way I was seeing it was going to devolve into more of a 60-40, 65-35 in favor of Hampton over Najee. Now that Najee is out, I mean, my God, Omarion Hampton might be a borderline first round pick if we were drafting today, because Justin Herbert is playing at an MVP level. This offense is going to score a ton of points. They're being extremely pass heavy, which you might think isn't great for running backs, but it is when your running back is very good in the pass game, as Omarion Hampton is, and they're just going to generate a lot of red zone and scoring opportunities. So, I mean, Omarion Hampton was a first round pick for a reason in the real NFL draft. Behind him now is going to be guys like Hassan Haskins, a special teamer, Kimani Vidal. Maybe they'll pick someone up off the street. But I could see, I think we will see Omarion Hampton touch the ball 15 to 20 times a game for one of the best offenses in the NFL. And it's just like really hard to fail when you have that kind of usage.
Putting aside the Madison Beer X factor with Justin Herbert, what's been different with Justin Herbert this season?
He's always been so good, man. Last year, he battled a plantar fascia injury, which I think limited some of his mobility. He wasn't running as much, but you saw late last year, final 5 or 6 games, they went to this really throw heavy philosophy, did the Chargers, and you start to see Justin Herbert do really special things. And then this year it's just continued. He's been 100% healthy. You see him being really mobile. Arm strength has always been completely off the charts, and he's just a really, really, really good player. Like, to me, him, Josh Allen, and Lamar Jackson are the MVP front runners right now. I'd be surprised if anyone else really gets into the mix there when it's said and done at MVP.
All right, moving on to number 6, Dak Prescott. Is it time to dump him in fantasy? Because I have him as my quarterback. This is a selfish question here. He's the QB18 through 3 weeks. CeeDee Lamb out at this point. Is it time to move on from Dak Prescott in fantasy?
Yeah, I mean, you saw the thesis for Dak Prescott hit in week 2. Their defense is so bad, and their run game, you know, could turn. I thought it was going to be worse than it's been. It's been okay with Javonte Williams, but now they have 2 offensive line injuries as well. Booker and Beebe are both down. So you saw the thesis play out in week 2. You know, don't run the ball that well. Defense is terrible. Dak drops back like 50-something times. He has CeeDee Lamb. He has George Pickens. The problem now is without CeeDee Lamb, there is a huge hole. I have not been that impressed with George Pickens. They have Kevontae Turpin. They have Jalen Tolbert. They have Jake Ferguson. They don't have like big time playmakers here anymore. And so I think Dak, anytime you take a quarterback in a single quarterback league at like quarterback 8 or quarterback 10 or later, it's always fine to just stream, you know? Like, there's probably quarterbacks on waivers. Each week, play the right matchups. If Dak has a great matchup, I'd be fine streaming him in even without CeeDee, but you can probably find better matchups. You certainly can this week as Dak faces the Packers, and no, I would not want to start Dak here against the Packers with no Lamb, maybe no Booker, no BB, etc.
I might just roll the dice with Jackson Dart. if I can get him off of waivers.
Yeah. Just go. I mean, it's a risky one, but there's probably other guys too. Like, you know, who knows? Like Daniel Jones, Justin Fields.
And you can
only start one quarterback.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Can start one quarterback. My league is a bunch of people
quarterbacks.
No reason. Just drop them. Yeah. Give them to me.
I think that people do that because like their quarterback's names are like the ones they know. But for anyone out there who's like, if you have Josh Allen or Lamar Jackson, there's just no reason to carry a backup quarterback. 100%. You know, like you should be stashing backup running backs. Like say you were stashing, say you had Lamar Jackson, you're stashing a quarterback instead of Trey Benson. You would feel like such an idiot right now because Trey Benson is suddenly like a top 20 or top 30 player. And all it took was one James Conner injury where whatever quarterback that you have on your bench, yeah, if Josh Allen or Lamar Jackson gets hurt, great, you have a quarterback, but you just stream someone. You know, you could just stream someone and find something reasonable. So yeah, my bench in season long leagues is mostly backup running backs that are one injury away from being like a top 30 player.
All right, that's our 6 points. We're going to go for two here. Number seven, who do you predict is leading the waiver wire after week four? So we're looking ahead a week now. Who should I be getting ahead of? If I miss out on every waiver this week, who should I be trying to sign ahead of time?
Yeah. It's a difficult question. It's interesting. I would say two guys. Maybe this is too far off the board. Two guys that came to mind for me were Woody Marks, the pass down back for the Houston Texans. I'm worried the Texans are just like, their offense is just toast. I mean, worst offensive line in the NFL, with all due respect to the Raiders. Pass game looks broken other than Nico Collins. But this past week, Damian Pierce was a healthy scratch. Dare Igunawuble played zero offensive snaps. That allowed Woody Marks to play a ton behind Nick Chubb. And I don't really think Nick Chubb can play anymore either. And so you can really squint and see a path here to Woody Marks playing a ton down the stretch. Now, what is that worth on the Texans? I'm not sure. But if you're in a league where it's deep, I like having Woody Marks on my bench. The other guy that came to mind was this tight end from the Chargers, Aronde Gadsden. Will Disley was hurt and out last week, and you saw Gadsden make 5 catches. I don't know what's going to happen when Will Disley comes back, but Gadsden was also flashing big time in the offseason, had some real nice showings in practices and in preseason games. And so you can see down the stretch, you have a Chargers team is passing at the highest rate in the league, adjusted for situation. And you want to have guys in there that are talented. And I do think probably Gadsden is more of a natural talented pass catcher than Will Disley or Tyler Conklin.
I like those choices. Woody Marks, especially, I drafted him super late, been holding him, hoping it turns into something. But as you said, the Texans offense, and in particular, CJ Stroud looks so bad, just so awful. I'm just not sure like what the level of real upside is for him. So 100%. I'm going to hang on to him. But at the same time, it's like, you know, I also took Scataboo. I'm very happy with the returns there so far. I have, you know, Tootin from the Jags. I have Ollie Gordon as well. So I'm making an investment there, hoping for a return. Scataboo's providing it. Hopefully that continues. But with Woody Marks, I'm not so certain that's actually going to happen at some point. But he's definitely worth a gamble. Number eight. You continue, Adam.
I was just going to say that Woody Marks caught something absurd, like 200 and something receptions as a running back in college for Woody Marks. And anytime I see that, I'm like, gosh, maybe some team sees him as like a 10 carry per game guy. Because if he can get that, then he's going to catch a bunch of passes. It's just going to be natural for him. So, yeah, we'll see.
Exactly. And as you said, they're in need of more pass catching. And maybe Woody Marks becomes essentially their second receiver. So that's a real possibility with him. And number eight, just in general, what game are you most excited for in week four?
Yeah, it is this Rams-Colts game. I can't believe I'm saying this. Before the season, I never would have thought that Rams-Colts was the most exciting game of week four. But I am real curious to see how Daniel Jones and Jonathan Taylor fare against a very, very good Rams front. I mean, Colts already handled themselves very well against the Broncos, who have one of the best defenses in the league. Rams defense is going to be another very tough test here. So I think that's a really, really interesting spot. And then on the Rams side, all of this talk around Matthew Stafford's back just dominated the headlines in August. They even give him like quarterback sneaks like If he had a hurt back, he's out. They're out here giving him sneaks. So I don't know. It was like a misinformation campaign or something, but he looks very, very fine. And he only throws to two guys. I mean, like 67%, 68% of his passes go to Puka Nacua or Devontae Adams, which is going
crazy.
To break. It's going to break records. You know, he just throws these guys on every play. So it's so when you're playing DFS or anything like that, it's so valuable to know if Matthew Stafford hits, what does that look like? And we know what it looks like. You know, he's going to throw to two guys and Kyren is probably going to get there as well when the Rams play well. So yeah, I'm looking forward to that game for sure.
Yeah, that's going to be an awesome game at the 4 o'clock slot on Fox. Then on CBS, Baltimore, Kansas City, one of those teams is going to be 1-3 to start the year. Chief, Lamar Jackson, Chiefs Patrick Mahomes. Yeah. You think the Chiefs will be?
They have been struggling for a long time on offense when they do not have their weapons. Maybe they get Xavier Worthy back here, but I've been underwhelmed by Marquise Brown. Travis Kelce looks like he's done, and like they don't get Rashee Rice back until week 7. So it's just hard for me to see the Chiefs scoring enough to keep up with it, but they play so well in Arrowhead. I don't get into who's going to win the games as much, but I do think the Ravens are much, much better than the Chiefs right now.
Do you have any thoughts on what's behind this fumbling issue for Derrick Henry? Just bad luck or is there something?
Randomness,
just
yeah.
Random?
Yeah.
Just random?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, he doesn't have a history of fumbling and randomness, I think.
You think if there's an owner in a fantasy league who's panicking over Derrick Henry thinking, oh, I drafted an old guy, he's washed up, is it a time to buy low, take advantage of that owner?
I think so. Just on touchdowns, like Derrick Henry is so, unlike the Eagles who tush-push, Lamar Jackson, if they get to the 1-yard line, hands the ball to Derrick Henry. And so his touchdown expectation is just so high. So in standard leagues, you know, non-PPR, half PPR, I would be buying on Derrick Henry. Full PPR, you could convince me otherwise, but non and half PPR, the touchdowns are just so valuable.
Yeah, I'm with you there with him. I wish I could have drafted Derrick Henry at this point, you know, in full PPR if he's just not a pass catcher. But I'd buy low on him if the opportunity comes. With the Chiefs, it is fascinating, man. Like the Chiefs have the Ravens this week. 1-3 for them. It's very, very possible that with their schedule moving forward, they have Jacksonville in week 5, but then they have Detroit, Vegas, Washington, Buffalo, all leading up to their week 10 bye. There's a lot of tough games the first 9 weeks of the season for them.
You remember last year, they were like something crazy. I don't have the exact stat in front of me, like 10-0 or something in one score games.
Yeah.
It's something crazy. Like, you know, and the idea is that one score games are kind of random. The ball bounces one way, you miss a field goal here, you know, there's a crazy turnover here. They're close games. You're supposed to win like 50% of your one score games. The Chiefs won every single one. And I do think there's a skill there, right? Mahomes has a skill of executing the right plays down the stretch. However, it coming back to bite them, you know, like they're going to get into one score games and they're going to lose some of them this year. It's just going to regress some. So yeah, I don't think this is like a new thing where, oh my God, they're 1-3. They easily could have been 500 last year if they just didn't run as well in one score games. So yeah, we'll see.
Pretty crazy. Adam, please let people know where they can find all your stuff.
Yeah, if this is on YouTube, which I presume that it is, yes. You can search for us on YouTube, Establish the Run. Everything is free on our YouTube, so you can see what we're going have going on there. And then if you are on the Twitter machine, which is if you're serious about fantasy football, you do have to be on Twitter at Adam Levitan, all one word. You can find me there.
Adam, appreciate you so much for joining me today, man. Keep up the great work.
Thank you. Appreciate you having me.
A big thank you to today's three guests, Kelly, Adam, and Desmond. Be sure to check out the Yahoo Sports Network. That's our brand new streaming TV channel. The Yahoo Sports Network is available to stream on all leading FAST services. It's also streaming live 24/7 on yahoosports.tv, and that's where you can catch all of the shows on your phone or your browser. Thanks to Emmy and Ingrid for producing today's episode. Thanks to Father John Misty, as always, for the music. I saw him live on Monday night. And boy, oh boy, whew, that band is playing better than ever, playing their new album and all the hits from over the years. That amazing, amazing show. So check out Father John Misty if you haven't, and if you like the intro and outro music. Thanks again to you for giving us a listen. We'll be back again on Thursday with another episode talking more NBA. We're going to preview the Southeast Division with David Thorpe. That's coming out on Thursday. We'll have a little bit more possibly as well, depending on the news and what happens throughout the week. Have a good day, everybody. Talk to you soon.